FM and online at kbu.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work, to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBU Community Radio.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
It is 11 a.m. at KBOO Portland, your community radio. I've got a little reminder about what makes this possible, how this ongoing experiment in community-funded, community-centered community electronic media is able to continue. It's with the support of our community. We're going to hear about one of our neighbors who got involved in the manner and to the extent that made sense to them, and we're going to jump right in after that to the Radio Zine with KBOO's Zone Suzanne LeGrand. So stay tuned.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from The Hot Sardines, bringing their jazz to the Newmark Theater on Sunday, November 24th. Tickets available at portland5.com.
This is KBOO Portland. I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and today on Radio Zine, my guest is Arnold Drake World. Arnold is an artist and also an author of two books on paper flower folding and arranging. The first book is We Don't Fold, We Roll. And his most recent book, which is coming out at the end of November, is Why We Like What We Like. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about the art, about what you do. You do a very unusual kind of paper folding. Could you talk about what that is?
Well, it all started when I was on a car lot. I was selling cars, and a Hispanic lady gave me a paper flower, and she was explaining to me that in her country, they would use these flowers for weddings because when you're on the lower social economical side of the fence, sometimes you make do with what you have. And that's one thing they had lots of was paper, and therefore they made a lot of paper flowers. And when I first started, it was basically me and Martha Stewart when you would type paper flowers. Now there's a host of people out there. But when I started, it was just me and her. And what I basically do is I take a ordinary napkin and I transform it into a botanically correct flower using a Fibonacci sequence. And by doing it that way, it makes it so I can make it appealing to the eye, but at the same time, I can pretty much dictate what kind of person is going to look at that particular flower.
How is it that you dictate what kind of person is going to be attracted to the flower that you make?
Well, from trial and error and hanging out in a bookstore for over a decade, I've met my share of PhDs suggesting I read this book, that book, and things of that nature. And after a while, I kind of came up with my own little, theory on what people like and why they like it. And a lot of it was dictated by what people would come to me and ask could they purchase or buy. And it started narrowing down. When I first started, I was making 26 different kind of flowers. I was doing about three different styles. I was doing I call it the what I want to do style. Then I had my feng shui style, more based on the Eastern philosophy. Then I had the golden ratio sacred geometry style, which is based on the stuff that I currently do more of now. And basically the style that I'm working on now is based on the Fibonacci sequence of 0, 1, 1, 2, then 2 and 1 is 3, 3 and 2 is 5, 5 and 3 is 8, 8 and 5 is 13, 21, 34, and it just goes on and on and on.
And how do you use that to make flowers?
Well, I break it down to the simplest component, which is basically a stem, and then from there we'll add 2 sun leaves, and then we'll start adding the flower itself, as far as the sepals, the petals. There's all kind of parts inside of that flower. But to keep it simple, I try to make it to where when the eye first look at it, they'll see a 1. And then as they start going down, they'll see a 2, and then they'll see a 3, and then they'll see a 5, and then they'll see a 8. And by arranging it in such a manner that they can identify those shapes without really thinking about it. After the years, I've had enough people come through and pick different kind of flowers where at first it kind of caught me off guard, because I was thinking it just can't be that easy. It just can't be zeros and ones. But yes, it is pretty much that easy. I came to this, my own little theory, that art is based on hunting and mating mixed in a bowl. As a hunter, we're looking for 2 eyes, 2 ears in and out of a bush. Kill it, take it home, feed the family. Because of that, we have sports: basketball, baseball, soccer, hockey, ping pong, marbles, bowling, you name it. But it was a way that the females could actually judge or recognize the individual that they would consider as a, how should I say, a productive individual, because he was a good hunter. And that's because of that, he would get rewarded as getting top pick of the gene pool. And so that's the hunting side of art. And we still reward these people extremely well. We call them professional athletes. Average salary over $100,000. What do? Chase round things, kick it, or hit it with a stick. Most people are pre-wired to like certain shapes, and my job as an artist is to present those shapes. And so that's what I really try to do.
Did you teach yourself? Like, how did you learn all of this?
I tease my mother to this day. She just turned 88 in September. And when I was a kid, one of the punishments, or when you were getting on her nerves and she wanted to get you away, she would have you do little tasks. And she was a tailor at the time, and one of the things she always had was a bunch of these patterns. But that's not as popular as they are now, but back in the day, they had Simplicity, McCormick's, and you had all these patterns where you can make different kind of clothing. And my job was to go in there and make sure I would put the right, because sometimes she would mismatch patterns. She would add this collar from this pattern and this lapel from that pattern, and I had a good eye for that, and she knew it. So she would always send me to do the more intricate jobs where she didn't want her patterns mixed up. And so
you would organize her patterns.
Exactly. And now when I look at things, I can literally tear it apart and look at it like a sewing pattern. So it's sort of like my calla lily is upside down drapes with a point. But if you took the point out, they would be drapes, because it would have a lot of the same components as far as the pleats and having a balanced bottom and things of that nature. So a lot of what I do is based on putting these patterns away when I was a kid.
Could you talk a little bit about your first book, We Don't Fold, We Roll? What does that mean?
Well, when I first started, the only people that were really invited me were old folks' homes and third graders. I don't know what it was, but third grader teachers were more than willing to let me come in. And when I started talking to the kids, a lot of the things that I thought was important, they could care less. That was the last thing on their mind. It was, as one little boy told me, we'd rather play kickball than make spit flowers. And so at that point, I grabbed these kids and I kind of asked them, well, what should I concentrate on? And they basically told me, I said, concentrate on how to make the flower and make it simple. And so that's where We Don't Fold, We Roll come from, because with origami, you fold paper, you don't tear it, and you keep it in its basic shape. But with what I do, you can tear the paper, and you don't have to stick to a lot of rules. The only rule you really have to stick to is the Fibonacci sequence of 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8.
You said at some point that third graders were your best business advisors.
When I first really got serious with this, I went back home to visit my mother in Madison, Wisconsin. And at the local library, there was a bunch of little kits that would be there every day. And when it first started, I would just ask them little shallow questions to see what their little opinions would be. And then after a while, I started realizing their opinions were a lot more home-based than I thought they would be. I was going through my business plan. And so I would ask the kids certain things like stationery, for example, like what would you consider a good way to present what I do or leave some kind of card? And the first thing I'll never forget, a little redhead girl says, you shouldn't leave a card. I'm like, well, why not? It's because when our parents get cards, they talk about those people. And then they throw them away or they put them in a box and they never look at them again. But if you get gold stars and gold seals, well, those go in the refrigerator and they don't come down to fourth grade. Like, okay. So should I get gold stars and gold seals? And of course you could. That only makes sense. So I got my gold stars and gold seals. And the little boys explained to me, if I really want to be impressive, I need to get that one thing that his dad has. And I'm like, what is the one thing? Well, you press the gold seal. Press the gold seal. Of course, I couldn't wait to meet his dad. So when his dad came, I was like, well, what is your kid talking about? The one thing that makes it impressive. I'm a notary public. Then it all made sense. So I went and bought myself the hand press so I could actually embroider my own little creation. So now I do the PDX flower guy. And I do that on a gold seal. So if you were to meet me in Powell's or Starbucks, because I usually hang out at the downtown Powell's coffee shop, 9 out of 10, you'll probably leave with one of my gold stars or gold seals.
So was there anything else that the third graders taught you about business?
Oh, God, they taught me a whole bunch of things. They taught me that when I talk to people, I should look them in the eye first. I laugh when I think about it because a lot of things they taught me were common sense or the things that parents would tell them. You know, keep your chin up, look at a person head on, and then you introduce yourself. And then you shake their hand. Like, oh, really? Oh, yeah. That's really important. It makes you a big boy. Like, okay. And so they explained to me that when it comes to doing shows and things of that nature, I should concentrate on my presentation because nobody likes art. Art is for old people. When it comes to kids, that's lame. And so I'm like, well, what do you mean? I said, you got to be entertaining. Like entertaining, yeah. You're just making spit flowers. You got to take it up a notch. I'm like, well, what do I do? So that's when the little boys kicked in. They were the foremost authority on what keeps attention. They told me I had to do kung fu magic and juggling, or nobody would never watch me make spit flowers. So they went on the internet, and they actually found all these things I could do. And when I first seen it, I'll be up front, it threw me off my socks. This little kid was over there making stuff float. And I'm like, how did you figure this out? And he told me on YouTube, it shows you how to do everything. So he actually showed me a spot on YouTube that shows you how to make things float. So I incorporated the juggling, the magic, the kung fu. So now I trick little boys to get them to make calla lilies. Now, most kids know the game paper, rock, scissors, where you punch your hands, 1, 2, 3, scissors, 1, 2, 3, rock, 1, 2, 3, paper. Well, if you look at your hands, when you're doing scissors, that's three stoogers poking the eye. And when you're doing rock, well, that's a punch. And when you're doing paper, that's a karate chop. So between those three things, you actually got some pretty lethal hand movements going there. And I've explained to the kids that they knew the song. So if you ever see me in public, you'll probably see me doing a lot of hand movement. And a lot of those are actually based on real moves. Now, when it comes to the magic part, see, what I do is I have the napkin levitate. And if you're within, I say, if you're 2 feet or further away from me, it looks real. It even has me going at times where I have to stop and ask myself, where is that string? But when I do that while I'm making flowers, well, the kids are right. It does captivate people. It keeps their attention. And it makes it a lot more entertaining than just watching a guy roll paper flowers. People don't just approach you and start talking. They'll sit back, analyze, look at the situation, and then they'll wait for their moment. But Midwest, that's not the case. But back to here. while I'm here, I've learned that there's certain things I have to do to get people's attention, and sometimes I might take it a wee bit far. Well, this particular lady was looking at me, and every once in a while, I'll have a little fun. I got to keep myself entertained. And I gave her a full blast of the show as far as making that napkin look like it's floating. And I think she bit it hook, line, and sinker. She thought that thing was really floating. She stepped up and stepped out as quick as she could. But yeah, my favorite when it comes to having fun is I'll find a group of people, and I'll find one person that I'll make it a point that person can see everything I'm doing. And everybody else, I'll make it a point to not let them see one thing. And it is entertaining because you'll see that person telling them, he's making it float. He has the force. And the parents looking at him like, stop staring at the homeless man. And I'm like, he's not homeless. He's an artist. Yeah. Stop staring at him. And as soon as the kid looked back at me again, I got it floating and shaking in the air, all kind of things. And as soon as the parent looked, well, it's back on the table again. So if you ever come to Powell's and you see me working somebody, that's pretty much what's going on. I'm having fun with that one person who's looking, and I'm giving them the show that they actually came for.
So the fact that you also have incorporated kind of magic into how you start to talk to people must have given you an opportunity to meet a lot of different people.
Oh, God. I've met governors from all over the country. Dr. Elizabeth Hayward Steiner, the senator from Beaverton. I've actually met some dignitaries from outside of the country as well. And then I've had my share of PhDers and artists from all over come to me, and they give me helpful hints and tell me things I should and should not do. Small things like you should always sign your work and date it and put a place where it was made, things of that nature. So if you do meet me, I'll 9 out of 10 give you a golden seal with the place and the time, the date, when it was made, with a handwritten signature on there. Something that you can actually leave with and have a memory as far as being at Powell's or being in the Portland area. Because of that, that flower is in over 42 different countries to date. North Korea, Dubai, and Cuba were by far my most memorable moments, because I would have paid them to take that flower just so I could say, I got a flower that went to Cuba and Dubai and North Korea. Now, the North Korean person was a translator, which caught me off guard, but I never thought about it. They need translators for a lot of the documents and paperwork. And she happened to be one. And so that was a memorable time, because you think when you hear about certain countries that there's no in, no out, but no, there's people that's going in and out all the time, actually. And so that makes Powell's very attractive to me as far as the different kind of people I meet. I mean, I call it the full spectrum. I meet everything from homeless to beyond rich. I met a guy from Dubai who actually bought islands. Plus, I had a resource of information you just can't buy. You got a used bookstore that's a block. It's literally a city block. And you have books up there from every walk of life. So that really helped when I first started, because I would read books on fractals, on art, you name the subject. If it has something to do with art, from golden ratio, sacred geometry, how to mesh the feng shui with sacred geometry. I mean, you just name it. It's a book that has something to say about it.
And you also go to different places and show people how to do this. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I'm about to get back on the road. That's one of the reasons I was happy that I can get on the air, because a lot of the things I do, I kind of steer it through my crowdfunder, because that helps me on both sides. One, for the exposure, and two, so I can raise money to do more tours, lectures, and workshops. And right now I'm getting ready to do more lectures and workshops on a collegiate level, where I talk more about why we like what we like and breaking it down to the components, to where it's a lot easier to explain with the zeros and ones. And I'll probably get more into the financial aspects of it later, but for now I want to concentrate more on why we like, on a hardwired subconscious level, what really triggers us to say, I like, I'll buy.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, I had to do a little bit more research, but now I'm ready to go on the road to explain and show, because I use my flowers as my medium to show what we like and why we like it. I have a lot of friends that are pencil artists, drawers, painters, sketchers, things of that nature. And they were asking me the same questions any other artist would ask. Well, why don't my work sell? What can I do to make my work more polished? And I did the research, and it's really simple. There's three components. First thing you got to remember, people buy life. They buy things that looks like it could be alive or was once alive. It has a stamp in time. And the way you give things a stamp in time is actually pretty simple. Shadows, shades, and mirror imaging. If it has a shadow and a shade, I mean, at one time the sun was upon it, and therefore it lived, at least in that moment. And then if it has mirror imaging on water, glass, metal, well, same thing. You can't have a mirror image in a shade. You got to have that with the sun hitting it. And that stamps it. And the subconscious mind sees that stuff and it goes after it. Versus the next time you go to an art show, go look in the racks of all the things people didn't buy. And you're going to see a lot of those elements missing. And when you see all those elements there, you're going to find yourself staring at that picture a lot more, because that'd be one of the pictures you might consider buying.
Interesting. And for you, the paper flowers, it's the, what's the living element? The fact that it's like an actual flower?
Exactly. It has the components of the 1, the 2, the 3, the 5, the 8. And then I place them in such a manner to where it's easy to look at. I try not to make it too overcomplicated, because sometimes I'll get carried away where I call it the double helix. I'll put a on both sides, I'll put a 5, or on both sides, I'll put an 8, and then I'll narrow it down to 2 5s, 2 3s, 2 2s, 2 1s. And then, but that's more of the elaborate stuff. That's more for the weddings and funerals and things where people are willing to spend that kind of money. When I'm at Powell's, most of the flowers I do are in the range of $10 to $30. But I do have people that know the work that I can do, and they'll hire me to make arrangements for their weddings or let's say a special dinner, things of that nature, and then I'll go ahead and pull out the color, because usually I don't do color in public, but when it comes to special events, I will do color.
What's your favorite part of doing this work?
The look on people's faces. Right before I came here today, I had a 10-month-old baby boy, and after 8, they start tracking, so... But the little beady eyes I can get when I'm doing that magic trick, or when I'm doing a lot of the hand tricks, is to, if I could live and eat on that, I'd probably be really fat and wealthy. But since I can't, I can honestly say it's the most rewarding part of what I do. It's just seeing the true pleasure of somebody looking, saying, first of all, how is he doing that? And second, that's cool. As a little kid said, that's cool. That I like. And so I really emphasize a lot on getting my cool points while I'm making or creating my work.
So can you talk about the book that's coming out at the end of November?
Yes. My next book, I'm breaking it down into three parts. It'd be the calla lily, and I'll do a little history about the calla lily as far as where the Roman and Greek mythology. And then it's the rose. That'll be in there. And then it's the morning glory, and then I make a trilogy, so that way I can talk about why we like what we like, and I can break it down into segments, and at the same time I can build it up to where I can explain these are the components and the elements that you build into and upon to create art. And so I use those three as my basic models, you might say. But yeah, what started as a hobby just got way out of control and became an actual book.
If people wanted to know more about your work or to see some of the examples of what you do, where could they go?
Oh, God. The easiest way, I always tell people, just Google my name, Arnold Drake World. But if they go to my crowdfunder, that'll spin them off to a lot of other places. That would be crowdfunder.com/ Paper Flowers 101. And if they do anything like a contribution over, I don't know, $40, I'll send them a flower, and I'll actually send them the manuscript to the next book coming out, We Don't Fold, We Roll.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Susan.
So I've been talking today with Arnold Drake World, or as he's sometimes known, the PDX Flower Guy, and about his new book that's going to be coming out at the end of November, Why We Like What We Like. And if you want to find out more about his work, you can go to PDX Flower Guy. Thank you so much. This is Suzanne LeGrand for Radio Zine on KBOO FM. This is Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and today my guests are Diane Steinbrecher and Shannon Pernetti, authors of The Treasure Within, an archetypal unfolding to your infinite potential. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Suzanne.
Thanks for having us.
So both of you are psychotherapists with over 40 years' experience. You talk about archetypal pattern analysis. Just so everybody understands, could you tell us what exactly an archetype is?
Anything that comes into form. For instance, if you're going to build a building, you're usually going to get an architect to set up a blueprint so that everyone knows what different things to do to create the very building. And that's, archetypes are like a blueprint. They bring things into form through a specific way, which is why the fetus goes through those different weeks and changes And the same baby from Botswana will look the same as one in Portland at 4 weeks. That will have the same level of development. Now, of course, sometimes there's anomalies, but basically that's an archetypal field.
So think of it as a blueprint, and that form can't come into form without that blueprint. There was an original blueprint.
So as psychotherapists, how have you used this concept in your work?
Well, people align with some of the major archetypes. We all have to align with the archetype of the mother and the father, whether the person is there or not, or whether the sister plays the role of the mother, they're still playing the role of the archetypal mother. Of course, in psychotherapy, we're working partially with how we align with the archetype. Do we align with it positively? Do we align with it negatively?
Like, for instance, mother and father, because they're our major archetypes. They're so much of how we organize our life. We can't change the fact that we had a certain mother or a certain father. Maybe we never saw the father. Maybe it was even artificial insemination. But there's always someone there that you have to deal with in your life.
That takes on the role, the archetypal role of the mother and father. And then because they're all different, you're aligning with different aspects of the mother archetype, for instance. And what we want is to be aligning with most of the facets so that we know ourselves in relationship to all those different facets. And most of us just have a few. And particularly if they're non-generative, we really want to align with the generative aspects of the mother. And that can take a while, depending on the mother.
And the other thing about the mother and father archetype is that the mother helps develop our inner world of emotions and feelings and love and tenderness and nurturing and protection. And the father helps us develop our outer world. So that's the masculine and feminine. And so those are very important roles that we have in our life. Now, mothers can help develop our outer roles and take on that role, but then you still feel the missing of the father in helping you in that role.
So how could the average person apply this idea of archetypes in their daily life?
Well, there's so many ways to apply it, but I think looking at what our alignments are to the mother and father is really a significant way of applying it. And that's how one of the things that we really work on in our, you know, our daily practice with people. Mm-hmm. You know, the mother archetype is so significant in our life. You know, it's our primary relationship, of course. But
and so
you know,
that's
what,
how we relate to ourselves.
Right. What
could you explain?
Well, we take in our mother, and then that's how we mother ourselves. So to broaden our archetypal experience of the mother, we want to learn all the generative ways that we can mother ourselves, and also learn all the negative ways to be able to make a choice to not do that.
So by generative here, you mean positive?
Well, it's more than positive.
It's like what will engender growth? Yeah.
What will really help us be all that we can be?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right,
it's really supporting
our potential.
Right.
Okay.
Supporting
our infinite
full potential. Our infinite potential, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how understanding different stages of life helps us to develop our potential? Because this is part of the aim of the book, for people to develop their full potential.
Right. To be on that road, because it's infinite. What we did was study Eric Neumann, who's a Jungian analyst. He was
Jung's favorite pupil, actually.
Yeah, and a really phenomenal being. And he wrote a book, Origins and History of Consciousness. He had an archetypal developmental theory that lies in potential for all beings. So similar to the forms lying in potential is the development that we can become lies in potential for all of us. But so many people don't go very far on that developmental map.
Why not?
Some of it is that they don't even know the map exists. They don't know what their potential could even be. And when I work with people in my practice and they hear about how to come into their treasure of being, it's like something lights up inside of them that wasn't there before, because they haven't been told about this, you know, that this lies in potential for everyone. So the treasure is a place in development where you've transformed to a place where you know your purpose and you can bring your gifts, your unique gifts, because we all have our own set. But you know that I came to this life for this purpose, and I have these gifts to bring, and you start bringing those into the world. And I think that this is a lot of what is needed at this time. The more people that can attain their treasure and really know who they are, and that their true essence and their authentic self, these are the people that are going to be changing the world. These are the people that can change, you know, climate change and, you know, some of the really big things that we've got, gun controls and, you know, killings and all of that. Because once we get into that place, we're not in our reactive states anymore, and we're not projecting out into the world like, you know, there's someone to blame. You know, we're in a very different place in our life. Center of gravity.
I think that a lot of people can relate to wanting to find their true gifts and be able to express them.
Absolutely. Everybody wants that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're kind of wired to actually go there.
Right.
But you know, our culture doesn't exactly support that. It kind of says that the stage of development where you can do abstract thinking is the farthest that you can go. And in the current research on adult development, the later stages of adult development, you can become a person who is really has their moral and their ethical and their wisdom available for the world.
What is it that prevents people from accessing or knowing those gifts? And how does archetypal patterning help us to discover or make more use of them?
Well, in our book, we lay out the stages of the Great Mother, which is the first 7 years of life plus in womb, and that is unconscious. But most people...
Just because the brain hasn't developed to be able to...
The brain hasn't developed well enough to go beyond that, to really go into a narrative and making meaning out of your life until you're after 7 years of age. That's the most recent neuroscience says that. So during that period of time, what gets laid down is our value and worth first. And that's where most people get stuck. You know, if you talk to the majority of people, they will tell you, I don't feel good enough. I don't feel important.
And why does that have to do with the mother archetype?
Because the mother is the one that is in the oral stage of the Great Mother. You know, the mother has the baby in her arms, hopefully, not always though, and is feeding her or him. And if a mother is holding their baby and gazing in their eyes, their true essence as this beautiful being, this precious, precious being, they get, oh, I am important. But if instead the mother feels her limitations, and that's what she's gazing into the eyes of her baby, or she's not gazing at all, then naturally what happens with infants is that they believe, I'm not important, or I would be treated that way. But the mother
is... all of that kind of clogs the system. It's over the treasure, and it has to be found with consciousness and cleared away so that the treasure can shine through.
And how is it found and cleared away?
Well, this is a big chunk of work, you know, usually when people come in and don't have that, because there's... they want to push away those feelings rather than we say, welcome them in, really embrace them, because all of these feelings and these thoughts have a story to tell, and they need to be honored.
And when they tell the story, they can then be acknowledged and released. But until that story is told, sometimes they just stay.
And a big missing experience for people is being seen, heard, and understood.
Right. Really listened to.
And when that happens, it's transformative for people. So there's that piece, but there's also a point where people need to become a good mother to themselves.
Yeah, because we look at all the ways that they're behaving in their life that maybe they don't even like. We all have those places where we know we should eat better, we know we want to do our art, we know that, but we don't act on it. And those are the places that this kind of covering shows up.
So we work with people on becoming a good mother to themselves in all aspects of life so that they can really become their fullness.
And recognizing archetype is part of being able to repattern?
Yeah, the alignment that they have to the archetype is what we're looking at.
But you're right about that, because of the alignment, certain patterns automatically just engage the person, whether they're even choosing them or not. If you have a negative alignment, certain patterns are just going to erupt in your life. And I know you have that feeling when you're having an off day and just everything does not go right. You can't find a parking place, your watch breaks, you know, there's a million things. And then there's the days where everything goes right. Everything, it's like the door just opens and magic happens. And that has to do with your alignment, really, to your deep, deep treasure.
Could this also be applied to a larger context, a social context or a political context?
Let's look at Trump for a moment. You know, he is a perfect example of alignments with the mother and the father. He had a crushing father that we call castrating father because they just, you know, cut you to the bone. That's the kind of father he had. That's what he knows how to do. That's what he is doing. So that alignment of narcissism has not been dealt with. Mm-hmm. And in order to have a father like that, you've got a mother that's submissive, that stands by and watches while their child is being crushed. Both of those make huge impressions.
Knowing that about Trump, that he had a crushing father archetype and that affected how he acts now,
mm-hmm.
What can we do with that information?
Right. Well, we need to look at how we're acting similarly to Trump. I'm sure that we don't do it on the level that he does it. But I'm sure that you wanted to do something this morning and you said, no, you can't do that. You have to go to work. It's those ways in which we proliferate the same kind of crushingness. And that's what we want to clear because the treasure's underneath that.
Look at what our culture is going through right now. What is this an expression of? You know, in archetypal pattern analysis, what we've learned is not to look at things pathological, but to look at what is a perfect expression of what is unfolding, that everything that is unfolding is a perfect expression. And so why did we need, and I'm going to underline need, a president like Trump? He's doing a service to our country. It's bringing all the underbelly of stuff that has been in the shadow for a long time to the surface so that we can see it. Now we can do something about it.
And we can say no to it consciously instead of going along with it.
Whenever there's something outside of us, what we've been trained to do is look inside. That where we can really make a difference is our own growth and development. And our own, becoming more and more conscious. So if we look at ways that we're like Trump internally and start to shift those ripples go through our families, they go through our communities, they go into the world, they go globally. You know, it's like if you throw a pebble in a pond, it ripples forever.
So self-transformation is also social transformation.
And I think that that's why we were asked to write this book. Mm-hmm. You know, this book moved through us. It wasn't something we consciously said, we're going to write this. It was a force that moved through us. And it came out at this time, because we worked on it for many years, came out at this time. And it is a map for people of how to transform and do individual healing that then becomes collective healing.
Mm-hmm. Are there some particular practices that you offer in the book to help people find their treasure within?
In those first 7 years of life, that's what you're learning, what your inner life is, how it's being, the shelves and the things that you can put things on are being developed. And so many people, their families just couldn't support them. And so they don't have that inner refuge. And creating that inner refuge is really looking at how you can take care of yourself. And the places where you just want to, like, you don't want to brush your teeth before you go to bed at night. Those kinds of things are the way that it shows the places where you're out of alignment with your inner refuge. Not that you have to brush your teeth for your inner refuge, but...
But it sounds like that's a lot of what Diane talked about in terms of learning, given your whatever mother archetype you had, learning how to remother yourself. Is it the same thing?
To really develop a generative inner refuge means looking at any places that are out of alignment for your full potential.
And it's not easy because your patterns are usually going against that really creating that inner refuge. So it takes some outside help. It takes some mentoring.
But to go back to practices, there is an appendix in our book called Mindful Awareness, and it does go into the practices that you can do to not believe the stories of the mind and use them actually for what is your next step in healing. But most people believe that they are their thoughts and feelings. And how limiting is that? Because really we're this vast spaciousness of, you know, awareness.
Wait a minute. You're saying we're not our thoughts and feelings?
We are not.
Well, we're more than our thoughts and feelings. But we seem to just, our culture in particular seems to say that we're our thoughts and feelings. And that thinking and business is the most important thing. And what Diane's talking about is something much wider than that. She's talking about the treasure of our being, where we're really connected to our soul. And the soul is moving through us, guiding us, instead of our negative patterns.
It's what Jung called the self, capital S.
It seems to me that we live in an abusive culture, and many people who might otherwise be well are sick simply because they're mistreated, exploited, abused, and traumatized. So I'm wondering, is it possible to do this work on a cultural level?
There's 9 great myths that really typify how the unconscious develops. And our culture is kind of caught in the hero. The next stage is to go into the transformation, where the hero starts actually looking at himself and finding what was left behind. For instance, you know, nature kind of pushes us along. Maybe we didn't want to be an adolescent, but our hormones came in and then we were an adolescent. And everything that wasn't right in our family, maybe we couldn't be angry, maybe we couldn't express our sexuality, that all got put back in the unconscious. And then it's a barrier to finding our treasure. So going back and finding what we need to rescue is really where the culture needs to go next. And I think we're really pushing against that because we don't need to rescue coal. Coal is not what we need to rescue. We need to rescue the different parts of ourselves that have not gotten to live their full potential.
When those kind of traumas happen that you're just talking about, whether they happen, you know, in our childhood or it can happen in adulthood, that, you know, parts get split off so that we're developing, like Shannon was saying, you know, development pulls us through. But, you know, some parts of us, I mean, we all have many, many aspects of self. And some of those parts are pretty young yet. And what happens is that, you know, something will happen in the outer world and it will trigger that young part that got hurt, and then we're in a reactive state. This is a lot of what's happening with killing in the schools.
And you really notice it in traffic. I'm sure everyone listening has had the experience of wanting to project out on the person in front or next to them.
So you're saying that in those situations, projection is at work because people haven't claimed that part of themselves?
They don't look at what is the reaction that I'm having, and this is mine.
Where does it come from?
What is this about? What is the story that's trying to be revealed through this?
And that's the work that you're doing.
We teach people how to bring in those projections. And, you know, it's not about anyone out here. You know, I mean, the fact that you're angry because somebody cut in front of you, well, yeah, it's not a good thing. But what's this big reaction that you're having? That's because somebody cut in front of you or undercut you early in your life. Or there's some big traumas that, you know, activates. But if we pull in that and say, gee, you know, I wonder what that's about, and just sit with it for a while, it will get revealed.
In the last section of your book, you talk about the higher levels of adult development. Can you say what this is about? I mean, I thought once you get to be an adult, that's it.
That's what a lot of people think. Well, there, you know, there's quite a variety from what I was talking about the ways people are thinking and taking responsibility for themselves. And
remember, they've owned their projections. They're no longer projecting out anything on anybody else. So they're taking responsibility for themselves, and they're world-centric. They're not just looking after their own family, their own people. They're looking after everyone. They want the best for everyone.
What's the betterment of all beings? That's part of it. And these states go into what's called awakened or enlightened states of unity, where, you know, you're able to anchor yourself beyond thoughts and feelings. Not that those won't arise, but you see them for what they are. But you're really anchored in a whole different place within yourself. You're really living your true essence.
So one last question. Why do you think it's worth it to find the treasure within?
All human endeavor is in search of happiness. And most people find little bits of happiness, like they buy a new piece of clothing, for instance, and they're happy for, you know, a few hours or maybe a few days. But it's not lasting. When you're living your treasure, you found that happiness, because it doesn't come and go. It's everlasting. You feel a sense of love, seeing beauty in everything and everyone. There's contentment and peace and joy. And these are states that don't just come and go, because they are our essence. And this is always here. This isn't something that you develop. This state is here always for us, but it's eclipsed by our thoughts and feelings and what we call the ego. And when we're listening to thoughts and feelings and believing that that's who we are, we don't have access to that part of ourselves that is our treasure. That's why we need to do the work to clear and integrate those parts of self that got left behind, so that we really can know our treasure.
And I think some more examples are those people that we see that are clearly doing work for the world, that their own needs are not what's focusing them. You look at President Carter, who, you know, falls down, has to go to the hospital, and then is out building homes for other people. You look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is holding a place for all the progressives, even though she's had cancer and all the different things. She's not doing that out of her own ego. She's doing that for the world. So I think anyone who we revere in that way, where we can see that their needs is not what drives them. It's helping others and helping the world move to a higher level of consciousness, really.
I've been talking today with authors Shannon Pernetti and Diane Steinbrecher, who have just published a book, The Treasure Within, An Archetypal Unfolding to Your Infinite Potential. If people want to find this book, where can they go?
They can find it on Amazon. It's at Paul's and Barnes & Noble.
Well, thank you so much today for being a guest on Radio Zine.
It's really fun to do this with you, Suzanne.
Thank you, Suzanne, for inviting us.
Thank you. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
Thank you, Suzanne, for that. All of those remarkable and enlightening, mind-expanding conversations. Stay tuned. In just a few minutes, your mind will be expanded and repeatedly blown under the calm and sure hand of your host for Moving On, Don Jacobson, bringing you 90 minutes of some pretty good folk Americana, which will be taken up by the Song Circle, the roots of rock and roll, all into Democracy Now!, news and public affairs, and then a night of music and a whole weekend, which we can all do with the support of you, the listener. Isn't that great? Feed the circle, why don't you? KBOO.fm, click on donate. Or check out Give Guide. Yeah, we're participating in that. And anyone who contributes, I think it's at or above a certain amount, gets entered for fabulous prizes. But of course, the reason you get involved is because it matters. So to finish out the hour, we're going to give you a little foretaste of one of my favorite roots Americana artists, Mr. David Grisman. So stay tuned. Thank you.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Federal government stopped building new housing a long time ago, affordable housing. Also, private developers, they've gone up to the mansions. They're not building the little two-bedroom, one-bath house that I grew up in, garage converted to be a bedroom for my three brothers.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren at the Democratic primary debate this week on the nationwide affordable housing shortage of 7 million homes for extremely low-income renters alone, according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. Yesterday, two bills on housing were introduced in Congress, one by Senator Kamala Harris and Representative Maxine Waters, both from California, a state with a significant homelessness crisis. The other is by Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar. Estimates vary for the maximum amount people should be paying for rent, somewhere between 28 and 30% of their paychecks. But around 8 million people on very low incomes are paying over half. Here's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker's plan.
If you're a renter who pays more than a third of your income in rent, then you will get a refundable tax credit between the amount you're paying and the area median rent. That empowers people in the same way we empower homeowners.
It's notable that the first time affordable housing made its way into the debate was also the first time Julian Castro didn't make the cut. Castro served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under the Obama administration. Here he is in a tweet during that discussion.
Tonight's Democratic debate moderators did something that they haven't done in probably 30 years. They asked a question about housing. That's important because today we have a rental affordability crisis in our nation. I believe that housing is a human right.
And despite not being in the debate, Castro had a great night. It was his top fundraising day of the month. His campaign raised more than it had at the last two debates when he was on stage. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders got the biggest applause of the debate in response to President Trump's new policy greenlighting what international law considers illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
It is no longer good enough for us simply to be pro-Israel. I am pro-Israel. But we must treat the Palestinian